A quick warning before we get started. This episode contains depictions of gun violence. Please take care when listening to this show. I'm going to keep it real with you guys. I really wasn't sure how to start this episode. Like, how do we pick back up after we heard the contents of that police report? The truth is, I don't fucking know, B. But here's what I can say for sure. Started working on this project well over a year ago. And ever since then, I've thought about Chris Lighty almost every day. And for the most part, I was just straight up in awe of this guy and the journey that he made from the Bronx to the boardroom. And I still do admire that Chris Lighty, but I don't know how to reconcile that guy with the one I read about in the police report. When people think about Chris Lighty, they see Chris the dealmaker, the guy who managed celebrities and was so good at it that he became one himself. The reality is, most people who knew Chris didn't know what was going on inside his head. He didn't just protect the images of his artists. He was a master at keeping aspects of himself hidden too. Public Chris Lighty and private Chris Lighty, they were two different men. And very few people knew both. Our job now is to try to tell the story of both Chris Lighties. The public figure who was always in control, and a private one who was spiraling out of control. I'm Reggie Yose, and this is Mogul, the life and death of Chris Lighty, a production of Gimlet Media and the Loudspeakers Network. In this episode, we're going to explore some of the things that most people don't know about Chris. But first, we need to talk about one of the things he's best known for. Because at the same time that Chris was headed down a dark path, he hit a career high point. He made a deal that changed the music industry forever and secured his place in the hip-hop history books. And that's where we pick up on our story today. The story of Chris's biggest deal starts around 1999, and it starts with two men in two very different places. Chris is in Manhattan in the Violator management offices with walls covered in gold and platinum albums. But on the other end of New York City, at the very edge of Queens, an up-and-coming rapper is walking into the studio. The only gold in sight is around his neck in the form of one quarter and five nickels on a cross. This rapper is named Curtis Jackson, or 50 Cent. Nigga, this boo-boo, but you could call me 50. Fuck with me, the police had to get me. As you can hear in his song, straight out of Southside, 50's friends called him Boo-Boo, a nickname he got when he started dealing drugs at the age of 12. At this point, he's just out of his teens, not even old enough to drink. One thing about 50, he had a tough life from the start. His mom was a drug dealer too. She died under mysterious circumstances when he was just a kid. He was kicked out of school. He sold crack. He carried a gun. He started rapping shortly after getting his GED in a correctional facility. This guy had his hood credentials on lock. And when he introduced himself to producer Sha Money XL, he didn't just want to shake hands. Here's Sha.
One of the first things we immediately did, we slapboxed in the studio.
What is slapboxing, first and foremost?
It's when you slap your man in the face. Like, you literally... So he was like, yo, son, you know, you got hands on? I'll box.
Why is he testing your hands?
He's a tester. He wants to see who you are. It's like you put dogs in the kennel, and he wants to see if you're scared or if you're really going to do it.
And what are you thinking?
Nigga, I'm Haitian, bro. I'm used to this. Nigga, I'm going to fight, bro.
I'm used to getting tested.
Yo, let's go then. And he saw it. I wasn't scared. And it was that was the bonding point. You got to be fucked up and bad for him to like you.
50 had this attitude that said, I don't give a fuck. And he really didn't. He liked seeing how far he could push you. And then he'd push you further. 50 might have seemed like a loose cannon, but there was no question that he was talented. Around the time he met Sha Money XL, 50 got picked up by the Trackmasters, one of the hottest production teams in hip-hop. And that I don't give a fuck attitude came out in his music. Perfect example, a song called How to Rob.
Hey, yo, the bottom line is, I'm a crook with a deal. If my record don't sell, I'm a rob and steal. You better.
This is the song that put 50 on the map. He called out a lot of big names in hip-hop, line by line, and explained how he'd rob them. Now, rappers diss each other in songs all the time, but no one did it like this before. He dissed Jay-Z, DMX, Will Smith. To 50, no one was sacred. First up, he goes after Diddy and his girlfriend at the time, Kim Porter.
I snatch Kim, tell Puff, you want to see her again? Dance your ass down to the nearest ATM.
He's not just gonna rob him. He's gonna steal his girl and hold her for ransom. How fucking disrespectful is that? And maybe the boldest of all, when he went after Missy Elliott. And this is at the time that she's off limits and at the height of her career.
Run up on Timberland and Missy with the pound like you. Give me the cash, you put the hot dog down. I figured it out.
Missy put the hot dog down. Yo, he's calling her fat. 50, man. 50 had no boundaries back then.
So when you hear it, what are you thinking?
I said, oh my God, this whole industry's about to know who you are. And exactly that's what happened. And he shook the shit up.
People were pissed. Even Jay-Z spit a rhyme dissing 50. I mean, he said, I'm about a dollar. What the fuck is 50 Cent? But that only raised 50's profile more. Suddenly, everybody was talking about 50 Cent.
That was the beginning of him, his marketing genius. And he used that trait to this day. Beef is the way.
The bad guy.
War is the way. The bad guy is the way. Bad is good.
50 took that idea and he ran with it. Around the same time, he released another song called The Ghetto Quran. And in it, 50 called out a lot of drug dealers in Queens.
For you slow motherfuckers, I'ma break it down iller. Supreme was the businessman and Prince was the killer.
Remember? He rapped about all of the inner workings of their business, including the kind of incriminating details you do not expect to hear in a rap song, like who did the killing, where the bodies were buried, and who handled the money. But unlike rappers, drug dealers don't fuck around with rhymes. When they heard Ghetto Quran, they were pissed, like, who the fuck does this guy think he is, putting our business out there on the street like that? But 50 wouldn't stop. And if you take enough shots, eventually somebody's gonna shoot back.
Where are you at the time?
Queens, on the highway.
Okay.
Grand Central. Steph Lover's on the radio and she announced 50 Cent is shot. I go to Jamaica Hospital. As soon as I walk in that lobby of emergency room, his whole family's there, hysterical. And you couldn't see him. Like, it was just happened.
How badly was he hurt?
He was fucked up. I know his mouth was wired up and he really couldn't talk. He had a bullet in his fucking gum. For real, that shit was fucked up.
How many times did he get shot?
9 times.
50 was shot in both of his legs, his hands, and his left cheek. A bullet was lodged in his gums. It looked like he might not make it. And if he did survive, he'd never walk or speak again. And just like that, he dropped off the map. Nobody saw or heard from 50 Cent. He was gone. But a few months after this all went down, Sean Money got a phone call.
He was like, yo. I said, who this? He said, 50. I said, I couldn't hear him. Like, 50? He's like, yeah. He couldn't speak. And he said they put Humpty Dumpty back together again after that. That was his next line. I was like, what the fuck is this nigga talking about?
He was talking about making his comeback. He was ready to get back in the studio, but he'd never be the same as he was before.
He just started to rap again, but his voice was different and his slur was different. So he sounded really different.
When you heard the difference, did you think it was better when you heard it?
Yeah. Absolutely. And you felt the pain. And you felt his energy.
It's like a superhero origin story. 50 had been hit with radioactive bullets, and somehow it made him better and stronger. He still had a piece of the bullet fragment in his gums, giving him a slight slur and grittier sound. 50 and Shaw got back to work, and 50 had a new lease on life. This was his second chance, and he's got crazy drive, and he's making 2 songs a day, and he just wants to make hot shit and get it out there. Shy had the perfect spot to make this happen.
Yo, bro, I'm out the hood. Come to my house. I got a studio in the basement. Yo, bro, I'm lit, bro. This is before lit, but I was like, yo, I'm good. And he came, and he saw it. I was in the suburb, youngest kid on the block with a motherfucking crib, 24 years old, in Long Island. And I had no mama upstairs. Nobody tell me turn the music down. Nobody tell me don't smoke. We was in my house.
This is your house.
Blast that shit, smoke that shit, light that shit, rock that shit, rap that shit. And we recorded for 2 years straight in my basement.
But while 50 and Sha are working all the time in Sha's basement, 50's record label drops him. And no matter how good his rhymes are, no matter how good his music is, most of the other record labels don't want to touch him for one obvious reason.
Everybody was scared.
Scared of what?
Listen, someone came to assassinate him, okay? What's stopping him from doing it again? It's a job that wasn't finished. So you want to be next to him that next time it happened? You want to be that show promoter that booked him and then you in the dressing room and all of a sudden y'all all get shot? Nobody wanted to be there because you didn't know when it was going to happen again.
Sha's going to industry parties every week, repping 50 hard, telling everyone, 50 is the shit. You gotta sign him. He's worth the risk. But no one would take a chance.
And then Chris Lighty actually listened to me and said, yo, I'm gonna come to your crib.
Chris took a meeting with 50 and Sha. And when Chris Lighty was trying to sign someone, he knew what to do. He'd go to them. Just like he did when he linked up with Fat Joe at his drug spot. So he shows up alone at Sha's basement in Long Island, walking right past all of 50's security sitting out front.
Chris was alone by himself. He had all his goons out there. And
like they, 50 had
Yeah. So it was like that. And then they were like making it militant, like he's coming in, like that. Chris comes into the basement and he's like, he's not scared. And
what did that mean?
That meant a lot. This Chris Lighty coming to us. He's coming to us. And he's at the crib. And that was it. Man, let's do it. And we fucked with him.
Here's Chris telling journalist Dan Charnas what he remembers about that first meeting.
He tells me his plans. He plays me the music. I listen to the music again, and I'm like, this shit is incredible.
Yeah.
He's like, yo, you could be Suge. I could be Pac. You could be Puff. I could be Big. We just got to one to it like that so people will take me seriously, and then they'll take some of the edge off of me getting shot and all of that because people are scared of me.
Chris signed 50 to Violator Management and got him a recording contract with Shady Aftermath Records. That's Eminem and Dr. Dre's label. Now 50 had gone from being a hip-hop pariah to having a record deal with one of the hottest companies in the business. But you got to remember, 50 was still a marked man in the streets, and he still had a target on his back, and he couldn't take any chances. A guy with a reputation like his needed to take extra precautions.
He's in a bulletproof now. He had the money. That was the first thing he bought. You don't lease a bulletproof. You buy it out cash right.
Bulletproof
car. $250,000 cash.
And once Chris got into business with 50, he couldn't fuck around either.
I remember it was scary at first when my dad started working with 50 because my father was wearing a bulletproof vest to go to work.
This is Chris's eldest daughter, Tiffany. She was 11 years old when her dad signed 50.
I saw the vest in my dad's trunk, and I remember lifting it up and how heavy it was and, like...
Did your father ever talk about that with you, or he just kept it separate?
No, yeah. He didn't really talk about that. I mean, I'm surprised he even let me see the vest.
A lot of people might have been freaked out about having to wear a bulletproof vest to meetings, but Chris was used to having people come at him. He started as muscle. He went toe-to-toe with Suge Knight. He was comfortable with this shit. Maybe even liked it. One of the friends Chris talked to a lot during this time was Sophia Chang. She was a manager working with Wu-Tang Clan members, Old Dirty Bastard, the GZA, and the RZA.
I remember talking to him about 50 and saying, in a way, you're the only one that could really manage 50. I never could have managed 50. And I'm a fucking great manager.
And you've managed Wu-Tang. You've managed...
Yeah, I couldn't... If 50 had come to me...
With a bulletproof vest.
As highly implausible as that would have been. But if he had come to me, I would have said, go to Chris.
Why?
I couldn't do that. I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to fucking deal with that kind of beef and that kind of... I don't know. I don't have the background for that.
50 seemed to relish the idea that everybody around him wanted him dead. He was leaning into that image. And the music he was making was pretty much saying, yo, come for me, pull up. For example, his song, Many Men, Wish Me Death.
Better watch how you talk when you talk about me, cause I'll come and take your life away. Many men, many, 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 many men, wish death on me, Lord. I don't cry no more, don't look to the sky no more.
The violence 50 was describing in his music wasn't just staying on wax. He had already been ambushed once, and now the people around him were becoming targets in real life too. Coming up after the break, the violence gets very real for Chris Lighty. Welcome back to Mogul. Before the break, 50 Cent was still hot on the streets, and things were becoming very dangerous for the people around 52. And then, in January of 2003, on a bitter cold Thursday evening, was the end of a regular workday at the Violator offices. But suddenly, out of nowhere, became anything but ordinary. At about 7 p.m., gunmen entered the elevator Chris Lighty's office on 25th Street in Manhattan. When the elevator doors opened up onto the 11th floor, they showered the Violator reception area with bullets. Bullets hit the doors. Bullets shattered the glass wall. Spent shells littered the floor. The gunman escaped on the elevator while the building security guard bolted to the stairs, trying to race the elevator to the bottom floor. But the gunman managed to get away. No one at Violator got hurt that night, but two things were clear. One, that this shooting had something to do with 50 Cent. And two, that Chris was in serious danger. A month later, six bullets were fired at a car parked right outside the Violator offices. It was an SUV that belonged to Busta Rhymes. Again, no one got hurt, but it was not lost on Chris that him and Busta had the same model car. That drive-by could have been meant for Lighty. This all happened in Chelsea, normally the land of upscale boutiques and tech offices. But the drama around Violator had turned the block into a war zone. Now Chris was looking over his shoulder every day as he walked to work in one of the busiest cities in the world. For most managers, this would be it. This would be the end. They would drop 50 in a second. But Chris still saw the advantage of doing business with 50. Because despite being the bad guy that's threatening people, getting shot and getting shot at, 50 was about his business. Sophia Cheng remembers how Chris talked about 50 at the time.
Oh, he said he was super professional. He said he doesn't do any of the nonsense, so if I don't have to chase him, he's on time for every meeting. He's not getting high. He's not getting drunk.
He doesn't
do any of that. He's not chasing girls. He's working out. He's just, and I mean, what a perfect client for Chris, right? Here I have a client that all of my ideas and all of my vision to just forge ahead as managers, we're not all that lucky.
Chris got really lucky. 50's debut album, What Shady Aftermath? Get Rich or Die Trying was about to be a monster.
We gon' party like it's your birthday. We gon' sip a Bacardi like it's your birthday. And you know we don't give a fuck, it's not your birthday. You'll find me in the club.
This song, In the Club, you couldn't go anywhere without hearing it. The album flew off the shelves, selling 5 million copies in the first 3 months. Went on to sell 13 million copies. That's not just platinum. That's 13 times platinum. That's diamond. He went from being on the fringes to being the undisputed hottest hip-hop act. But despite all of that success, Chris saw something that a lot of other people would not see for years. Yeah, 50 was selling a lot of records right then. But because of online streaming, record sales were down and they were going to stay down. The industry was changing, but an artist like 50 could make way more money in endorsements, selling sneakers and his own branded stuff. So this whole time, Chris was behind the scenes selling 50 as a brand. When the album came out and it was a smash hit, Chris seized the moment and lined up deal after deal after deal for 50. First up, a clothing line with fashion designer Mark Echo. Then, it's a video game. Remember this?
It's some crazy ass shit. But that's the hood. A hard place to live. And an easy place to die.
And finally, a sneaker deal with Reebok, featuring 50 rapping about his signature kicks.
T-Unit footwear, T-Apparel. I'm so hood, that blue and that white looks so good. Hip-hop, man. We gon' take it to the next level. Kicks match that hat and that dope back. Kids stay color coordinated, man. You know that. Truth is.
And it wasn't just 50 for that one. Now he had a crew of a few young rappers from Queens, the Gorilla Unit, or as you might remember them,
G-G-G-G-Unit. G-Unit was on fire.
This is industry kingpin Steve Stout, who also helped launch the careers of Will Smith and Nas. Then he worked on that Reebok deal with Chris, Sha, and 50.
That was so hot. And in the sneakers, they both knew what they were doing. They priced it right. And they went for the $70, $80 sneaker, and they sold a boatload.
Everyone wanted those G-Unit sneakers. They broke every sales record in the book. G-Unit even sold more sneakers than Allen Iverson. And he was the biggest star in the NBA at the time. This was unheard of. But the biggest deal was yet to come. The one that changed everything for 50 and for Chris. One day in 2004, Chris was sitting in his office brainstorming. Here's Sha Money again.
Trying to think what's the next thing, because it was really popping.
And you and Chris are having these conversations? Or?
Me, Fifth, and Chris were sitting in Chris's office and have these conversations. And we were sitting there, and Chris was like, liquor, liquor, liquor. I was like, vodka, vodka, liquor. Yo, just do 50 Cent liquor. That shit'll go. It'll go, it'll go. It's like, yo, I don't even drink liquor.
The guys tossed around a few ideas before 50 came up with something different. He said, let's do something bigger. Let's do something that everyone needs. Water. Chris takes 50's idea and starts calling around to water companies. He had a connection with a small company in Queens called Glasso. They sold a drink called Vitamin Water. Now, back in 2004, Vitamin Water was not a brand people knew about. They were a regional company. They were just getting started. But for Chris, it was perfect because they were open to his input. Chris's pitch went something like this. 50 would endorse one particular flavor of Vitamin Water, a flavor that has special significance to him. Here's Chris.
It had to be grape because everybody drinks grape Kool-Aid in the hood. And grape was the flavor that resonated well within our community. And we felt if we could bring grape to the community, it hones in not only with the kid, but with the kid's mother and everything, because they all grew up on grape Kool-Aid. Right. This is a version of Quarter Waters.
Quarter Waters. They were these drinks you get at the bodega. These sugary juices that only cost you a quarter. And that was the idea. Take this thing from the bodega and sell it for way more than just a quarter.
I remember him talking about it. So imagine a drink like this. An energy drink in the hood. It's a 50 Cent drink. It's like, yeah, it's fucking brilliant.
They called the new drink Formula 50, and the deal was signed that year. But this wasn't an ordinary deal. Chris made one big bet in those negotiations. Rather than get the usual, a one-off endorsement check, he got 50 equity in the small company. Ownership. It turned out to be a very good bet. Vitamin Water blew up. It sold everywhere across the country, from bodegas to upscale gyms. And it got more and more popular. Between 2006 and 2007, sales skyrocketed. Then, in 2007, jackpot. Coca-Cola bought Vitamin Water for $4 billion. Because of the move Chris made when the deal was signed, 50 Cent made somewhere between $40 and $100 million. He made so much money that 50 just had to brag about in his song, I Get Money.
I took Quarter Water, sold it in bottles for $2. The Coca-Cola came and bought it for beans. What the fuck? Have a baby by me, baby. Be a millionaire, I write the check before the baby comes. Who the fuck
can? You gotta understand that before this, companies borrowed the hip-hop cool, and they'd get it for cheap. They'd get a rapper to wear their product or mention it, and they'd give them a small check, and that was it. But now, with this Vitamin Water deal, artists, black artists, were finally getting what they deserved. Rather than smiling for the man, they were the man. Here's music industry powerhouse Troy Carter. He managed stars like Eve, John Legend, and Lady Gaga.
That Vitamin Water deal was the wake-up call for all of us, for every artist across every genre, not just hip-hop, country, everywhere. Rock, everybody said, give me a piece.
And this is all Chris Lighty's brainchild.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
After this, 50's face was everywhere.
Everybody knew who 50 Cent was after that. My father knew, 50 Cent? Oh, he's on the news, 50 Cent, yeah.
And it wasn't just a big deal for 50 Cent. Chris had a huge payday, somewhere around $10 million. And a lot of us in the industry, we knew that for Chris, this is one of his biggest catches. And when you pull down a huge number like that, you expect to be set for life, buy yourself an island, and relax and kick back. But it doesn't always work like that. Chris had a lot of expenses. For one, his business. I used to run my own business that was a fraction of the size of Violator. And yo, the bills were unbelievable. You got Manhattan rent for the office, plus overhead and keeping the lights on. There's salaries. There's health insurance. It goes on and on. And that's just the business side. You got to account for his family, too. He supported his mother, plus 7 kids from 4 different women. That's private schools, college tuition, car insurance, houses, vacations, birthdays. It's just exhausting going down the list. And let's remember, Chris never knew when his next payday would be. One year you have a vitamin water deal, the next year you're cold. In the music industry, you can never rest on your laurels. You can never feel good and secure, never feel that your work is done. Chris had to go out and get another deal after another deal, and there was no end in sight.
And it pushes. It's like a conveyor belt that doesn't stop.
Here's Vibe editor-in-chief Daytwan Thomas.
It doesn't stop for you because you're successful. It's like, all right, how long can you stay on this treadmill? You know, how long can you run this out? And if you run and you fall, do you get back up?
Chris had gotten up so many times before, but it was getting harder and harder. The first sign that something was really off for Chris came in 2007. Chris couldn't pay his tax bill, and it still remains unpaid today. And that was just the beginning, because now, on top of everything else, a $2 million lawsuit landed on him. See, a few years back, Chris went into business with a guy named Michael Ovitz. He was this big-time Hollywood agent. Lighty was going to bring his artists to Hollywood, and Ovitz was going to make them all movie stars. When the deal didn't go the way Chris expected, he wanted out of the contract, but Ovitz wouldn't let him go. Chris then spent the next 4 years in litigation. As an attorney, I have to say, B, 4 years is really a long fucking time to be in a legal battle. And what's worse, at the end of all of this, Chris lost to Ovitz and had to pay him $2 million plus the legal fees for both of them. That had to hurt. Dan Tronis explains the impact that lawsuit had on Chris.
The way that Chris reflected on it was the way that you reflect on a divorce. You know, he said to me, he said, you know, with Lior, it was one thing. You know, Lior would get angry, but Lior didn't want to see your kids in the street, right? That's what he said about Ovitz, you know, the kind of guy that not only, you know, wanted the lion's share and wanted what you had, but wanted you to be destroyed. Chris Lighty, I think, never got over that.
But Chris was still spending. Shortly after he started paying out that Ovitz settlement, he finished construction on a new house in Miami, which cost him a couple of $1 million. That year, he also bought 2 apartments in Chelsea for over $5 million. But then, Chris was hit with forces way bigger than hip-hop.
You know what? Right now, breaking news here. Stocks all around the world are tanking because of the crisis on Wall Street.
Pauline Once the recession hit in 2008, the whole music industry just dried up. And there were less and less deals and for less and less money. Shit just kept piling on. I mean, Chris was like a fucking football player trying to get off the field in mid-play. He keeps taking these financial hits. Hit after hit after hit. And Chris got hit again. He was completely blindsided when he found out he got caught up in the Ponzi scheme of the century. He had invested with Bernie Madoff. Here's Chris's friend, John Turk.
What happened with Bernie? Like, where was Chris before Bernie and what happened afterwards? Financially, if you know.
He lost a lot of money with Bernie. He just played it off as far as in front of the media.
Right.
In the public. He's like, it's just a couple hundred thousand or whatever. It's no big deal. Nothing to talk about. Oh, it was a fucking big deal because it was his nest egg. It was his retirement. You got to remember, Bernie got people for billions of dollars.
Yes. So he probably got Chris for millions.
Yes, with an S.
Right.
Yeah.
Did Chris talk to you about it?
We didn't like really get into it because we didn't have to. Yeah. But it was like, you know.
He gave you that like. Yo, I just got taken.
I
just caught an L, yeah, my friend. I caught
a
an
big L.
L.
Right. Yeah, he was like, I just caught a big L. Right. Yeah,
but in a sense, at that point, it financially wiped him out. Financially crippled him.
It crippled him.
We were unable to verify how much Chris had invested with Bernie Madoff, but his brother Dave Lighty told us that at one point, Chris believed that his account with Madoff was worth $23 million. Chris had to take action to mitigate his mounting debt. Here's Chris's daughter, Tiffany.
Do you remember anything about the impact that the recession had on the business and your dad?
Yes, definitely.
Was he stressed out about it? Do you remember him seeing stressed out about it?
Yeah, I remember us just downsizing, like not having two Bentleys, having one. Like, it's ridiculous that he had two, but, you know, that was just, you know, the rap game.
But, you know, he could afford it at the time, and he couldn't.
Yeah. Yeah, he was able to afford it, and then afterwards, it was just like, okay, what do we need, and what do we not need?
Right.
But first, it was, you know, one, and then it was eventually he just got rid of both. Just liquidating things that we didn't need. Also, my car.
Your car.
Yeah.
Chris was millions of dollars in debt, selling off assets. And each year, there's another tax bill not paid. By 2011, things had gotten so bad that Chris doesn't pay child support for months. Just 2 weeks before Chris died, a warrant was out for his arrest for the unpaid child support. The pressure of all of this financial turmoil would be a lot for anyone to deal with. But there's one final thing that landed on Chris shortly before he died. Back in 2007, Chris started a company called Brand Asset Group. It was a joint venture with Warner Music Group and Violator Management. The idea with Brand Asset Group was that Chris could expand the reach of Violator Management beyond just his artists and cut even more deals with more people. Chris had hoped it would be the thing that could get him out of his debt and set things right. Warner gave Chris a loan to get the company going. We don't know how much money he was loaned. Sources say it was anywhere from $3 to $6 million. We know from public documents that loan came due on August 22nd, 2012. On August 30th, Chris would be found dead. On the next and final episode of Mogul, the last days of Chris Lighty.
You know, I sent him a text message, and all I said to him was, in this message, are you okay? And his response to me was no.
New episodes of Mogul come out every Friday. Mogul is a production of Gimlet Media and the Loudspeakers Network. This episode was produced by Eric Eddings and Meg Driscoll, with help from Isabella Kulkarni, Jonathan Mena, and Peter Bresnan. Our senior producer is Matthew Nelson. Our editors are Lynn Levy, Caitlin Kenny, and Chris Morrow. Fact-checking by Michelle Harris. Sound design and mixing by Haley Shaw. Music direction by Matthew Bull. This episode was scored by Nana Quibena, with additional music by Prince Paul and Don Newkirk and Haley Shaw. If you like the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It's a great way to help new people find out about the show. Follow us for all of the latest news and a behind-the-scenes look at the making of the show. Our handle is @Mogul.